Have you ever heard somebody say to you, relax, trust me? I know I'm a little guilty of saying that to my kids from time to time, and they get a little tired of hearing it, but there's some good lessons there. But really what we're talking about today is not a mere personal trust, but that deep underlying conviction in the reality and the allness of God, where that personal trust is well-intentioned, and sometimes okay, it's not quite as certain as that reliance upon God. And sometimes that human trust falters, but our trust in God never does. When I was thinking about this topic and this title, I was reminded of an experience I had a few years ago when, before we had moved to the Colorado area, my wife and kids and I were out visiting, and a friend of ours came in to the Colorado area of Ouray with us. And one of the things I love to do is get up into the mountains and go four-wheel driving. And my wife does not like to do that with me. I don't think she trusts me on the road. But this buddy of mine is like, sure, I'll go with you. And so we had spent a great day up in the mountains exploring and seeing the scenery and taking pictures and picnic lunch and just having a little bit of adventure when it was time to go home. We thought, all right, well, we kind of looked at our trusty map and thought, well, we knew where we were, and so we took a turn on this road and thought we were on our way home. And the road started to get a little more technical than we had anticipated, but we were trusting our map and trusting that we knew where we were, so we pressed forward. And after a few of those kind of scary hairpin turns where my friend actually got out of the vehicle because he didn't trust me driving it, we came around this bend and there was a snowfield in front of us. And you could see the other side maybe a quarter of a mile down the mountain. And I kind of hesitated for a little bit and thought, well, this doesn't seem quite right. But my friend kind of leans over to me and says, trust me. I did it all the time when I lived in Oregon. We'll get through that no problem. Well, about 10 feet in, we stopped, high-centered, right there in the snow, not going anywhere. And after a few moments of kicking myself for not trusting that inner voice which had previously told me to stop before getting into the snow, we assumed the task of digging ourselves out. And it didn't go all that great. We didn't have any tools, and so we came to the realization that we were pretty much really stuck. A little bit of prayer led somebody to find us. We were not on the main road up there in the mountains. And this dear couple in an ATV was driving through and came across us and tried to pull us out, but they couldn't. A couple hours later, after securing a few more ATVs, we were able to get the Jeep out and kind of reverse course and get down the mountain. And it was a big lesson on trust for me, because here we had been trusting this map, which turns out was really just hand-drawn, not to scale, and lacking some very important details. And then I was trusting this friend, who I really respect. And to this day, I still trust him to a degree, but I've learned not to trust him before God, before that inspiration, which really leads us to know what we should be doing and what's right. And so when somebody says, relax, trust me, you know, that's okay. But let's just make sure that that trust is truly centered on God being that real me, that capital M there. Trust, as I like to think about it, relates to this idea of assurance. The assurance that all is already and always well. There's really no process, no doing. Trust is based on that already present reality of being that awakens thought, and it serves to correct the impositions before our thought. We mustn't take it for granted, otherwise it might seem to diminish. But even then, if we find our trust in God seeming to falter, where fear and doubt may attempt to reign, a little reasoning might be helpful. In actuality, our trust really isn't lost. I would say it's more misplaced. Think of somebody who you know who is sure they're going to fail. Well, they have trust. They just have trust that they're going to fail rather than trust in their success. They have trust in that negative outcome. So part of our task as students of Christian Science is to ensure that our trust always lies on that solid, that right foundation of trusting in God. Now, likely we've all found ourselves at one time or another questioning that trust in God and God's love for us. Ultimately, though, we do all know better. And we know we can trust what we know about God to be true. And we can trust that God does love each one of us as his children. Often in hindsight, those worries we may have had, those doubts and fears, are almost laughable. But from the vantage point of facing a proverbial mountain of problems, we have to remember that experience perspective and trust the lessons that we have already learned, and trust that ever-present assurance of God's love that we've learned not only from that experience, but also through our study, through our practice. Really, though, my goal here today is not to try to convince you to trust God and his law as exemplified in the lives and works of Christ Jesus, demonstrated in the practice of Christian Science. I'm not here to build you up and try to increase the profit margins of the movement through an effectively mounted trust campaign, as many businesses might try to do. Rather, it's my hope to really remind you of what I know you already know, what you've already been demonstrating, what you're already living. And we heard some of that with these reports today, that practical proof of God's care and love. And we're recognizing that this proof, this love of God, this love of God for each of us, really is that rock, that firm foundation that we are standing upon, not the shifting sands of mortal belief. Something we can all trust in. You, your patients, your friends and neighbors, your co-workers, are already perfect in God's eyes. Each one of us is already one with our Father, Mother, God. We each are already the full and complete manifestation of mind. We are right here and now, the very loved of love, the very thought of truth's knowing of its own infinitude, the very expression of mind's wisdom, soul's grace, and spirit's vitality. Now, no amount of trust is going to change that. And it's certainly not going to increase the already established fullness and completeness of God's creation. As our leader reminds us in the chapter on prayer, in talking about prayer, she says, prayer cannot change the science of being, but it tends to bring us into harmony with it. She also writes, prayer cannot change the unalterable truth, nor can prayer alone give us an understanding of truth. But prayer, coupled with a fervent, habitual desire to know and do the will of God, will bring us into all truth. Well, this right reasoning, this trust, and this right starting point of our work is important to refute those beliefs of sickness, sin, and death. We're not changing the forever fact of God's infinite grace and love, nor of his idea, but it does ensure that we are maintaining that right perspective and standing with the divine principle. We're standing with that truth of perfect God and perfect man. And once we've gleaned that perfect perspective, that right perspective, it serves as a foundation for our trust. So that no matter the false suggestion arguing for legitimacy, that right standpoint of an enduring trust in the principle of divine law quickly and effortlessly neutralizes the false arguments of self, sense, and sin. Really, that's what we're doing here today, is celebrating all of Glenn's proof of that, not just in concept, but in reality. We're cherishing the strength of this mission of Christian Science Nursing Healing Ministry through our prayers. The weary, the aged, the sick want this place of refuge that provides a sanctuary to support and strengthen their thought and to buoy their trust and help them prove those healing demonstrations. So it is that each of us, whether we're staff or just a volunteer or a community member, must be prepared to answer that call, to be ready workers holding forth the standard of scientific healing. Now, as I was thinking about this idea of trust and how to explore it a little bit deeper, a helpful idea came to thought, an acronym, where we take the each letter of that word, trust, T-R-U-S-T, and you use it to serve as the first letter of a word that will help kind of deepen that meaning. And you may be familiar with the acronym for fear, false evidence appearing real and how we see that that false evidence isn't something we need to fear. So we're going to use this for this idea of this acronym that I came up with for trust to kind of guide us through the rest of my remarks today. T-R-U-S-T, truth revealed and understood, is scientific treatment. As we continue, we're going to look at this idea of trust as just that. The revelation of God understood according to His divine laws, having a direct and marked impact in our lives for good. Trust isn't blind faith or a mere hopeful longing. It is based in God, revealed to us through inspiration and the very nature of God to make Himself known. Then we reason with these ideas to make them our own and understand their import in our lives. As our leader writes in talking about trust, in Hebrew, Greek, Latin, and English, faith and the words corresponding thereto have these two definitions: trustfulness and trustworthiness. One kind of faith trusts one's welfare to others. Another kind of faith understands divine love and how to work out one's own salvation with fear and trembling. Lord, I believe, help thou mine unbelief, expresses the helplessness of a blind faith. Whereas the injunction, believe and thou shalt be saved, demands self-reliant trustworthiness, which includes spiritual understanding and confides all to God. Now, this acronym of mine, Truth Revealed and Understood is Scientific Treatment, is more than just a fun play on words. As I've been working with this idea of trust, I really see the spiritual import of each of these ideas as strengthening my concept of trust and where that trust should lie. So let's start with the T. Truth. And really, by this we mean, of course, anything referring to God. It's that which keeps our thought focused on what is real, so that we're able and ready to reject the false claims and the false evidence of the material senses. It's very much like what our leader shares on page 275 of the textbook, where she talks about that starting point of our work in divine science, being God's Spirit is all in all. A favorite Bible story of mine is the healing of the epileptic boy, which we had in the lesson recently, where, of course, as you know the story, the master was able to heal this young man where the disciples did not. It becomes so clear as we look at that story that the master was fully conscious and really only conscious of his and everyone's relationship with God. His rebuke, O faithless generation, was a rebuke not to the disciples themselves, but to their misplaced trust, to their trust in matter, and their trust in the picture of this disease parading before them. Now, the Bible doesn't tell us specifically whether this young man had a seizure in front of the disciples or not. But we do get the sense from this story and Jesus' comments to them that they were clearly impressed by what they had seen. The master, on the other hand, was not impressed. He was unfazed by that very picture. In fact, even when in giving his treatment to this young man, the child went into a seizure and, according to one of the accounts in the Gospels, appeared to pass away. But did the master lose faith? Did he doubt? No, he just went forward doing what he did best, and that was healing. Of course, then, trust that we're talking about is not a namby-pamby, wishy-washy trust. Like the master, it needs to be rooted on the rock of Christ, exemplifying that clear and direct love of God for His creation. The master's prayers were, as our leader writes, deep and conscientious protests of truth. This is our standard. And as the account continues, we're given another blessed lesson on faith, prayer, and fasting in the master's answer to the question from the disciples as to why they couldn't heal the young man. I asked myself, why is it that faith as a grain of mustard seed, as we know from Jesus' response, why is that tiniest amount of faith so effective? For starters, I like to think because he's referencing a faith being so pure and concentrated. When I think about a mustard seed, it packs quite a punch in terms of flavor, but also in terms of overcoming the limits of its size, because as we know, a little bitty tiny seed grows into a nice big tree. But in terms of our work, it's not really about the size. A grain of truth, that smallest little inkling of truth, is of course going to be more powerful than all of error put together. Why? Because truth is real, and error is not. Error, evil, hatred, sickness, sin, revenge, those carnal mind beliefs, as we learn from the example of the Master and our textbook, are merely the absence of truth, God, or good. Or we might say they're the absence of the belief in God, because you can really have no absence of God. And so our scientific reasoning assures us that if God is all, and we know that God is, then evil and error are nothing, having no place, no power, no means, no method, no nothing. Logically, then, even the smallest amount of something real is going to naturally serve to correct and rebuke that which is not real. As we read in the textbook, that only is real which reflects God. The other aspect of this idea of the seed, and I've alluded to this already, but it's a call to make sure our faith is absolutely pure and resolute. Jesus is affirming that we don't need to spout a bunch of doctrine or mere words. Sometimes we find ourselves doing that, just throwing these ideas of truth out there. But what he's really getting at is the need to humbly, silently, firmly turn thought to God. To have a faith that is unquestionable in its expression. Our leader talks in the chapter in prayer about becoming conscious for a single moment. That's what Jesus is alluding to here. It's not about trying to convince ourselves of the truth that we're arguing in thought, as if there was something else real out there pressing upon us and convincing of us of its reality. What Jesus expresses rather is a certainty in God's reality and working out from that standpoint unimpressed and unmoved by any mortal suggestion. There's only one reality, and a clear thought to that effect literally does move mountains. Let me give you an example of this absolute truth removing the so-called mountain of incurability. Many, many years ago, I went to visit a patient, and it turned out that the daughter of this patient was in town visiting with her mom, and we were able to meet at the facility and had a chance to speak while I was waiting for the caregiver who was attending to the patient in the room. And we had this daughter and I, it was kind of an impromptu conversation, but it was very holy. It was a wonderful opportunity to talk about my journey into the practice and her family's experience in Christian Science. And we just had a lovely time sharing ideas. And we were also able to talk about the work that she's doing for her mom and what I was doing as the practitioner on the case. And her mom was up there in years and seemed to have quite a laundry list of issues that this daughter was concerned about, I guess if you say. But it was a special time of just acknowledging God's love, acknowledging that presence of the Christ, and communing together in that, sharing that. And she was very comforted after our conversation. And then I was thrilled to get a call a couple days later. After she had gotten home, she wanted to call and thank me for the time that I spent having the conversation with her. And she expressed her appreciation for the love that I was sharing towards her mom, of course, but also for her and taking that time to meet with her. And she shared how it really helped to still her thought and calm her fears. And she was so grateful for that faith and that love and that trust that I was exemplifying. And as a side note, she wanted to share something with me. She had been diagnosed earlier with the claim of macular degeneration and had been told that there was nothing that she was going to do about it except for lose her sight eventually. And it had been very troublesome to her, and it was weighing on her thought quite heavily. After she got home, she just knew that she was healed. right there in our conversation. And she had gone to the eye doctor and had that confirmed, and then just couldn't wait to call me. I think she got walked in the door and picked up the phone and called me to express her gratitude for that. And it was a beautiful example of what the Master calls upon us to be doing, to be living each and every moment, that firm foundation of faith and trust in God, and to be so conscious of it ourselves that even if it's not something that specifically we're trying to address, because she didn't bring it up in our conversation. She didn't say, well, can you treat me for this? We were just talking about God and His love and the reality of that God, that love of God, and the love that we had for God just transformed her thought. As I thought about it for myself, what went on there, because I didn't give her treatment, not in the direct sense, but it was that aspect of knowing that reality of truth, this T of our trust work, being so clear and absolute that we're not fooled by the counterfeit idea, something else trying to masquerade as truth before us, whether or not it specifically comes out and says it, or it just may be in the atmosphere of thought. I was already working actively to counter the claim of blindness, because this dear patient of mine seemed to the human senses to be both blind and deaf and hardly conscious. So every time I went to those patient visits, there was just a real sense of vibrancy of life and that vitality of God expressing itself that I was striving to bear witness to, as opposed to this picture of decay and decrepitude before me. And this healing of this daughter was just a natural benefit of that already established work, being so conscious of the spiritual facts that I could be never conscious of a lie, even one that was hiding in her thought. And that's really what the Master is getting at about moving mountains. Yet at times, those names, those images, the sensation of pain in her body may seem to be so real, we're, for a time, fooled to try to deal with those beliefs. Now, they're not real, but just as sometimes a dream takes on a sense of reality, so we have to be alert to refute and reject the waking dream that would say it has reality and is capturing our attention. This is important because when we're simply trying to, for instance, do the work of making pain go away, well, what's at the very fore of our thought? Well, pain. We don't want the starting point of our thought to be what we're trying to get rid of. Mrs. Eddy tells us about the Master's work. Jesus beheld in science the perfect man. I love how often we get that in the Bible lesson. There was a time there where I think it was literally in every other week, and I was not complaining because I love that reminder. That perfect man is the standard of the work that we're doing. The claims of the dream have no bearing upon a thought so clear and focused on God. And I love, too, our leader's explanation of health along this line of spiritual reasoning. She writes in Rudimental Divine Science, health is the consciousness of the unreality of pain and disease, or rather, the absolute consciousness of harmony and of nothing else. You see, when we're wrapped up in that mortal view of things, when we're working, trying to work out healing a problem from the midst of the problem, then more often than not, we seem to be at the very mercy of the thing we want to have dominion over. And Mrs. Eddy talks about this a lot, but my favorite is where she refers to that as mental quackery. Also helpful is her counsel in Miscellany. Unless you fully perceive that you are the child of God, hence perfect, you have no principle to demonstrate and no rule for its demonstration. So quite literally, she's asking us, demanding of us, as was the Master, to declare the truth of our being, our nature, our identity, and that image of God. Otherwise, we may actually be trusting matter as an obstruction, more than trusting the omniscience of God. The need is to apply this science from that standpoint of absolute perfection. Rather than waiting for some answer to magically appear, we can realize that right here and now, man, each one of us, is the very full and complete manifestation of that answer that we seek. Rather than waiting for the right sense of home, purpose, family, supply, health to unfold, realize that right now you are already expressing the full and complete manifestation of those ideas. Be willing to relinquish that limited mortal sense of God and instead yield to the absolute, already established perfection of His perfect creation. We might offer our prayer this way. I know that I have all the answers I seek because I am the expression of the one mind which is already doing all the thinking. I trust Him because I am the full manifestation of His divine nature. Doubt and fear have nothing to do with me. I know that healing is simply the fading away of false suggestion, so that the what is already true perfection is revealed. I know that what God knows reflects is me, a divine idea. I am the very truth that God is knowing, the law of abundant harmony that principle is, the joy that soul sings, the functioning presence of everlasting life, the continual support of love's loving. I don't receive these wonderful qualities. I am these divine ideas which God manifests right here and now. So I am humble and can do nothing on my own, leaving all instead for Christ. Yet I can be all through reflection. Jesus is speaking to all of us when He says, "This kind goeth not out but by prayer and fasting." Knowing and sticking with this absolute truth that we've been talking about is the praying, gathering the fact from divine mind. The fasting, which sometimes might seem a little more difficult than the praying, is then refusing to let mortal mind suggestions have any power or presence or reality, even for a half a second. Now, Jesus didn't just share these ideas with us because they were catchy. His teachings and example were the direct result of knowing His Father, Mother, God. And He knew that as the Son of God, His words and acts were divinely inspired. As He said in John, "I can of mine own self do nothing." Which leads us to the second aspect of our TRUST acronym, the R, revealed. That idea of revelation, or the revealed truth. You know, it's vital to know the truth, but it's equally important to realize the origin of that truth and to ensure that that's God. The law of God and His Christ comes to our experience as the result of divine revelation. There's such power in that realization. These ideas that we're talking about today, these truths we study and practice in our lives each and every day, the very foundation of this trust that we have in God is revelation. The aspect of God making Himself known to each one of us right here, right now, even to the cat. In Science and Health, we read, "The divine understanding reigns, is all, and there is no other consciousness." The ideas we express and the words we read and study and the teachings have a divine source, and that's so freeing to realize. God is revealing His very nature and truth of His creation to each one of us, and He's doing so eternally. I love what our leader writes in the textbook when she says the intercommunication is always from God. Always, always, always from God to His idea man. Science is a divine idea, the law of God, revealed to human consciousness. It has never been our job to create the reality of God and its expression. Instead, we witness the power of the Word in our lives. As we're receptive to the revealed idea, the nature of our trust in God and His practical love manifested in our lives takes on new meaning as the revelation of truth penetrates individual consciousness. There are many wonderful scriptural examples of this, but I'd like to look to the beautiful gate of the temple that we read about in Acts. As you know from the story, Peter and John are asked for some alms by a lame man. Now, this lame man's thought was touched and healed by the revelation of the Christ idea in the words of Peter, Silver and gold have I none, but such as I have, give I thee. In the name of Jesus Christ of Nazareth, rise up and walk. Now, merely saying Jesus' name did not cause that man to walk. There is more to it than that, but not complexity, revelation. Peter and John were already so filled with the Holy Spirit, their lives, their thought was transformed by the time they spent with the Master. And then we know that it was deepened even further through witnessing his crucifixion, resurrection, and ascension. The revealed Christ was a living truth to them, brought to light through Jesus' words and works. So it was that their words and actions took on the power of that revelation. And equally so, this lame man was receptive to that revelation. It overwhelmed him there, such that we know he was leaping and shouting and jumping for joy as he went into the temple. Don't Jesus' words and works do the same for us here today, even though it might seem to be 2,000 years later? We have his same teaching and example to follow. We also have his words, where he spoke of the promised comforter. As our leader writes about that, in the words of St. John, he shall give you another comforter, that he may abide with you forever. This comforter I understand to be divine science. Whenever I pause and think about that, for even just half a second, the impact of it really sets in. We have the same authorization to heal mankind as did Peter and John, as we let in the revealed idea and allow it to strengthen our trust and practice. We too can heal the sick, cleanse the lepers, raise the dead, and cast out demons with that very same authority that they exemplified. We too can say with that revealed idea, in the name of Jesus Christ of Nazareth, rise up and walk. You think about it, our faith, the very practice of Christian Science that we're here today to celebrate, was foretold by Christ Jesus. Each one of us today is part of the fulfilling of that revealed idea. The best healer ever to walk the globe gives authorization to not only our words, but our faith and our practice. He foretold it, and we are fulfilling that prophecy through this healing ministry. I don't know about you, but that tends to tell the doubts and fears in my thought to take a hike. To quote a popular line from a 1980s film, see if you can remember what it's from, "We are on a mission from God." Anybody know that movie? Joe's got it.
The Blues Brothers.
The Blues Brothers, that's right. So we have that same protection and privilege being on a mission from God that the disciples had, not just those two characters from the movie. In Miscellany, Mrs. Eddy writes, "Christian Science is absolute. It is neither behind the point of perfection nor advancing toward it. It is at this point and must be practiced therefrom." And in the textbook, she refers to science as the final revelation of the absolute divine principle of scientific mental healing. So as we think about this idea of trust from this standpoint of revelation, we know the ground whereon we stand, the basis from which we work, is solid. The revealed Christ puts us on that rock of truth. Mere human opinion, will, etc., are the shifting sands of mortal belief, and a mere wishfulness in healing. But the idea of revelation and the absolute scientific basis of the practice of our faith ensures the success of our work. We have the Word of God and the authority of His Son literally telling us we are on the right path and that we are safe to continue. No matter what the world might try to say, there's the authority that we can trust. Even while it's all the rage in society to discount faith in God, to put it on a medical basis or whatnot, the revelation to consciousness of God's love and care for each one of us, as expressed through His holy word in the Bible, serves to negate that mortal static and to ensure us the authority to continue in the work with the assurance of our victory. As we move on to our next letter, the U for understanding, it's a way to further strengthen our trust in God. Without understanding, it's just blind faith, and blind faith is not what moves mountains. So once the idea of truth has been revealed to consciousness, we need to ensure that we understand just what that idea is and why it matters in our lives. The holiness of the Christian Science practice and that of Christian Science nursing, the sanctity we find in church, the inspiration that comes from study, and the freedom we experience in healing, these ideas all serve to deepen our understanding of the revelation in thought and to prove to us that truth is real. In Proverbs, we read, "Understanding is a wellspring of life. Understanding grounds us. Understanding solidifies thought in the face of upheaval. Understanding serves as a reservoir that strengthens us in times of need, and it shores up the reasons why we continue to pray and study when there seem to be so many alternative solutions, or at least suggestions of solutions, to the challenges that lie before us. Just as revelation provides that divine authority for the ideas coming to consciousness, understanding is how we take that idea and begin to make it our own, to make it relevant and practical right here and now. As our leader writes, faith advanced to spiritual understanding is the evidence gained from spirit, which rebukes sin of every kind and establishes the claims of God. An important aspect of this idea of understanding, then, is to pray for ourselves daily, so that we can strengthen and protect this growing understanding of God and His law. I love how Mrs. Eddy implores in miscellaneous writings, "One thing I have earnestly, greatly desired and again earnestly request," I'm sure you're all familiar with this, "namely that Christian scientists here and elsewhere pray daily for themselves." We can't skip out on that important aspect. And I love, too, how she shares the answer of that prayer, that growing understanding of God, is not when we're praying for bread to be given a stone, but more grace, obedience, and love. As we do this work for ourselves, the impact is such that it can't help but elevate the thought of all around us. As Christian Science practitioners, as Christian Science nurses, as church members, community members, family members, we bring the light of truth to bear upon all in need of its light. Trustingly, with our consciousness filled with the grace of God, that love is revealed and understood, and we become better healers. That's what was going on when I had that conversation with that patient's daughter. The simple dedication to God and an understanding trust in Him does heal. When we individually commit to the acceptance of His grace in our lives, we are able to bless others whom we serve and encounter. An atmosphere of thought aligned with God and maintained is tangible and is a blessing. Our daily work is necessary not only to align our thought with God, but also to help keep it there. It's important to understand that we don't do this work because we individually, in and of ourselves, have the power to enable healing, as if we are strengthening our brains and understanding in order to be able to heal better. No, Mrs. Eddy is quite clear throughout the teachings that the human mind is not a power. She writes, "Every function of the real man is governed by the divine mind. The human mind has no power to kill or to cure, and it has no control over God's man. The divine mind that made man maintains his own image and likeness. The human mind is opposed to God and must be put off, as St. Paul declares. All that really exists is the divine mind and its idea, and in this mind the entire being is found harmonious and eternal. The straight and narrow way is to see and acknowledge this fact, yield to this power, and follow the leadings of truth. Mind is the healer, and our job is to yield to that truth and the power that accompanies it. I really enjoy working with the last sentence of that quote, where there are four vitally useful ideas that help us to strengthen understanding. See, acknowledge, yield, and follow. The first step is we have to be open and looking, which will in turn enable us to see. Now, being a new resident of Colorado, and I'm trying to get into fishing a little bit. I'm not a fisherman, and my stepdad, Barry knows him. I see Barry back there. Is a fisherman, fly fisherman, has loved to kind of get me out there and go fishing. And so when they came out to visit us recently, my stepdad and I went with a guide to go to a local river, San Juan River, and had a day of fishing. And I learned a very important lesson about fishing, which applies to this idea of seeing. You never catch a fish if the hook is in the boat. So it is that we have to open our thought to see the truth of God and His love, the power of the one mind. Thoughts stuck in the darkness of complaint, doubt, fear, always arguing for the error against the truth, is like a fisherman with his hook in the boat. We can remember that words of truth, even if they are just words without the depth of understanding and inspiration in back of them, are sure better than words of error. We're always thinking, so we might as well be thinking rightly. So let's open thought to see the glory of God. Now, I'm a terrible fisherman, but my odds are better when I get that hook in the water. So we may say, well, I don't know enough here, but if we start with the truth in some way, shape, or form, it's like we put that hook in the water. Well, now the next step is to actually acknowledge just what it is we've seen. You might see someone across the room. Without acknowledging them, you may potentially come across as rude. My eldest daughter, now in high school, tends to do this with boys. She pretends she doesn't see them. And the cuter they are, the less likely she is to acknowledge them. She's still a little embarrassed about that. But going back to what I learned while fishing, with my hook now in the water, which I eventually got it in there, not the greatest cast, but I got it in the water, I might actually see or feel the fish on the line, but if I don't acknowledge it, I'm not going to catch it. It doesn't show a readiness to do something about it. There were quite a few times on my fishing adventure when the guide would scold me for missing the bite. Now, I was looking at my indicator in the water, but I just thought it was bouncing around, didn't realize the importance of what it was actually doing. There was a fish there. I got better. But, you know, seeing it is one thing. We have to actually acknowledge it. We want to ensure that we're paying attention and realize the importance of these facts of divine science always coming to consciousness. The nature of God is to make himself known to his ideas. God is not hidden or mysterious. Now, sometimes it might feel like that only because we aren't looking, or like me with the fish, we're thinking it should be a certain way. And thus we fail to acknowledge that reality which is already there. How often I hear a patient tell me, it seems to be so difficult to hold on to the truths that I'm sharing. Well, maybe from the standpoint of the dream, but doing so, holding on to those truths, is natural, beautiful, and easy as we acknowledge the fact that God is all and that His love is always embracing us and is the only reality of our being. You might say that while seeing is an openness, acknowledging is the proof that we're actually paying attention and are ready to do something about it. And so as we yield, we actually are doing something. While fishing, going back to this example, after seeing the fish, acknowledging the nibble, one has to set the hook. In thinking about this idea of understanding, we might at first see something new in the teachings or hear something at a church service. But what are we going to do about it? By acknowledging it, we realize its value and importance. More so then, we aren't going to let it go by. We got to set that hook. By yielding in thought, we're going to stop and challenge thought to see that idea for what it is, as an idea of God. I'm sure we've all had those aha moments. You've read a passage for years, but all of a sudden you see it in new light, and in humility approach it with a fresh perspective. You might say we take the idea in and mull it over. We take it apart and put it back together. We might do that several times. Thinking it through, at which point it's not just some great idea out there that we've heard or read. It's now part of us. And therefore we can use it. We can apply it. And in this yielding thought, an essential point is our full and complete admission that the idea to which we are yielding is true. Lastly, then, we follow. What I love so much about this idea is, for me to follow, someone has already taken the lead. In this case, I'm referring to the Christ, that tangible expression of God's love for each of us. Having seen, acknowledged, and yielded, it is natural for us to be led in the right direction that brings manifold blessings and along the way continues to strengthen our trust. In speaking of her own experience at demonstrating just these ideas, Mrs. Eddy writes, "When the spiritual sense of the creed was discerned in the science of Christianity, this spiritual sense was a present help. It was the living, palpitating presence of Christ's truth which healed the sick." This understanding then is scientific and leads perfectly into the last ideas under discussion of trust, the ST, or scientific treatment. As I've already shared, the basis of our trust is God and His revealed idea. Thus, our practice of this understood truth is scientific. Intellectually, we know this, right? After all, we are Christian scientists, understood to be the science of the Christ, practiced and demonstrated in our lives and in our churches. Our textbook is Science and Health, with Key to the Scriptures. This idea of science is prominent. But we want to make sure we don't merely take it for granted and just let it be a nice word. Going back to this idea that I mentioned earlier, we have to do more than see it. We must acknowledge it, yield to it, and follow where it leads. Now, if we aren't alert, we might end up thinking we don't know how to practice better healing. We might say we don't know how to heal the sick and the sinning or to raise the dead. But the nature of something that is scientific, of our science, is that there are set rules and laws for its demonstration. We're not Christian guessers, we're Christian scientists. We're not just merely doing our best with a fairly good track record of success and caring for ourselves and one another. We are scientists in the truest sense of the word, and thus must use the science of the Christ to refute a mere human approach to science that says we are flawed mortals, subject to the limits that mortal science would impose on a material existence. So it is that we are ensuring our perspective on these laws of God as applied in our lives is rooted in that deep trust in God we've been talking about during our time together, with all of its revelation and the deepening understanding and the importance of that understanding in our lives. As we do this, our practice is certain. I love what Mrs. Eddy shares in the textbook when she says, "To mortal sense, Christian science seems abstract, but the process is simple, and the results are sure if the science, that law, is understood. The tree must be good which produces good fruit, guided by divine truth and not guesswork. The theologus, that is, the student, the Christian and scientific expounder of the divine law, treats disease with more certain results than any other healer on the globe. The Christian scientist should understand and adhere strictly to the rules of divine metaphysics as laid down in this work, and rest his demonstration on this sure basis." The trust we've been talking about is how we defend ourselves from that which, in belief, would cause us to question this certainty and to begin to doubt or be fearful. Our understanding of God and his revealed Christ rules out doubt and fear. It assures us that God is all and there is none else, and that these laws that we turn to are scientific. Despite so many claims to the contrary seeming to be placed upon us by world belief, it is a proven science that God is real, is all, and governs our lives with grace and truth. We each have proven it. It's been proven through the through the countless years, we have the stories in the Bible to turn to, even back in the Old Testament, through the Gospels. We have it in our periodicals, in our textbook. We have it in our church every Wednesday. We have it here at Olive Glen, each and every day. That proof is demonstrable, and each one of those proofs proves the science of this law. We need to yield to it. We need to make those laws our own. We need to stand firm in their scientific basis. But part of that is also being willing to impose those laws unapologetically on whatever the false suggestion is before thought. I love in the chapter Some Objectives Answered in the textbook how sometimes Mrs. Eddy is just so blunt. And here's an example of that, where she's calling on this law and demanding of us to prove it. It is objected to Christian Science that it claims God as the only absolute life and soul, and man to be his idea, that is, his image. She's unapologetic. She goes on to say, it should be added that this is claimed to represent the normal, healthful, and sinless condition of man in divine science. We must not forget that link, perfect God, perfect man. And that this claim is made because the scriptures say that God has created man in his own image and likeness. This is a scientific treatment, an understanding of perfect God and perfect man as revealed to us by God's own holy word. As we work from this basis, we find that we are able to naturally reject the erroneous claims masquerading as so-called legitimate ideas and thoughts, real either in our body or thought. This is science we're talking about. This is law. Now, I hear the argument upon thought, and I go there every now and then too. What am I missing? I'm doing this work. I'm studying. I'm yielding. I'm trusting. But I'm not healed. This is Eddy writes, if the student adheres strictly to the teachings of Christian Science and ventures not to break its rules, he cannot fail of success in healing. She doesn't mince words. Cannot fail of success. These laws of God, this law of God in science is fixed. Mrs. Eddy saw the certainty of God's law applied to every human condition. She was clear. We have to work from that highest standpoint, and that's what we're being demanded to do. We have to reject anything and everything that would hold us in the dream. When we do this, the result is scientifically certain. Remember, we're not discussing mere human opinions and nice ideas, but a divinely authorized and revealed truth. I'd like to share a healing that I experienced where that unwavering trust, that science of God's law, really impacted my life. It was a beautiful healing. One Sunday, my daughter, who's now in high school, was just a toddler, and we were playing on the floor, and it seemed in human sense that I did something, I don't know even what I did, to hurt my back. And it was only with great difficulty that I was able to stand. And for the rest of the afternoon and evening, I was unable to stand upright, to walk freely, and even sitting was fairly difficult. I kind of was able to hobble around a little bit and get the things done that I needed to do, but it wasn't great. And I have to admit, I didn't sit down and first start applying this science that I knew was effective. I just kind of thought, well, just looking forward to a really comfortable bed and a nice rest, and in the morning all will be well. And I actually slept great. Bed was very comfortable. And in the morning I woke up refreshed, and I heard my daughter giggling in her crib, and I thought, oh, what a great thing. I'll go get her up and we'll just keep playing. Well, when I tried to stand, I collapsed to the floor in a great deal of pain. And after making sure I was okay, my wife went to attend to our daughter so that I could attend to myself and really focus on the work that I should have been doing earlier. I was clearly, at this point, awake to the need to begin praying for myself. I couldn't ignore it any longer. And I had to start, really, honestly, with forgiving myself for not getting to that work sooner. As I sat there in bed praying, I was just listening for God's quieting thoughts. And as I prayed, I felt some relief from the intensity of pain, and then reached for my textbook and began praying with several ideas that really stood out to me, that helped change my thought about body and lift thought away from that sense of pain. one idea in particular that I really remember working with was where on page 167, our leader talks about that halting and halfway position. She says, not wise to take a halting and halfway position. And she continues, there is but one way, namely God and his idea, which leads to spiritual being. The scientific government of the body must be attained through the divine mind. It is impossible to gain control over the body in any other way. On this fundamental point, timid conservatism is absolutely inadmissible. Only through radical reliance on truth can scientific healing power be realized. As I prayed with those ideas, a couple of things became clear to me. The first was that in ignoring the problem, merely hoping for a good night's sleep, finding that right spot to sit comfortably, etc., they were very much halting and halfway in their approach, far from scientific, and they certainly lacked any desirable result. Though I knew better, I had experienced firsthand of the lack of any permanent healing in that course of just trying to get by. I also realized that if I wanted better control over my body, to be able to be stand and to be free of pain, I needed to moment by moment correct what I was thinking about myself with fundamental spiritual truth. I needed to apply this science without reservation. I took a stand to see myself as I knew God saw me, spiritual, whole, untouched, always by pain. At first it wasn't easy, but as I persisted in my work, I began to feel much improvement. After about a couple of hours of praying this way, I began to consider my day. It was a Monday morning, my routine at that point was to go visit patients at Peacehaven, which was fairly nearby. And I really didn't want to reschedule. That was the best day for the patients and the best day for myself to go and see them. And so I was thinking, how could I do this? But I didn't want to burden them with what I seemed to be experiencing. I didn't want them to see their practitioner not at their best. While freer and in less pain than earlier in the morning, I was sort of able to stand, but only about as well as I could the night before. And I hate to admit this, but I thought for just a moment how I might be able to tough it out and walk to the chair in the patient's room. I visualized, actually, from the door to the chair, could I stand upright? And could I sit down without grimacing? Gratefully, though, I was working with that statement about being timidly conservative. And no sooner had I thought that and had that image of could I get from the door to the chair than I realized it was very halting and halfway. It was not the right line of reasoning. It was falsehood. It was not scientific. And I right then and there committed myself to praying from that radical standpoint of relying entirely on truth. Anything else was absolutely inadmissible. So I sat down, continued to pray for myself, and canceled my appointments. Now, I don't remember what I prayed with from that point forward, but by lunchtime, I was completely free. I could stand and move without the slightest twinge of discomfort. I was able to keep an afternoon appointment, and then later that day, I was able to meet a friend in a nearby park and go on a 3-mile run. And during the run, I was just sharing with my friend, who was also a Christian Scientist, the joy that I had for being there and that healing that had taken place that morning. And I realized a very important lesson. I could have gone and toughed it out. I could have grimaced through the pain. I could have even protected the patient's thought from that. But had I done that, I would not have been on that run. I wouldn't have found that full healing that comes to that radical reliance, that radical stand for truth that brought healing. Part of what I was recognizing as I thought back on this statement is a statement that our leader makes in the textbook when she talks about healing. And it's where she writes, realize the presence of health and the fact of harmonious being until the body corresponds with the normal conditions of health and harmony. Now, that's not letting matter set the terms and conditions for us, but it is trusting God enough to stay with the truth, to stay with God in thought, even as we're working out our salvation. Well, thank you for sharing this journey of trust with me, but don't let it end. I know you will enjoy continuing to think about trust along the lines of what I've shared this afternoon as truth revealed and understood being scientific treatment. As I was out for a run yesterday along the river trail by my hotel, I thought of something my dad used to always share with me when, as a kid, I was working through something and needed to calm my thought. It was his definition of the word relax: to give up my human plan for God's love in action. So I guess, as it turns out, we really can relax and trust God. Thank you all.